Welcome, 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 beloved listeners, to another week of Linnell on Rin. He said, adjusting his headphone volume. Had a complaint today, sort of a slightly cranky Gladdy, pointing out that because I work close to Mike, you can hear my rasping breath. Now, what I'm going to do tonight, I promised to do this. I replied to the email. I promised that I was going to stop breathing. So I'm going to do the whole program tonight without breathing, which may, of course, lead to my death, to my extinction. Well, that's totally appropriate because that's what tonight's program is about, species extinction. So this may be it, as far as I'm concerned. Last week, the federal government announced a network of marine reserves around Australia, some of which will restrict commercial fishing, whilst others restrict future oil and gas developments. These marine reserves are not to be confused with those up the top end where we're letting US Marines in to growl at China. Tony Burke, the Federal Environment Minister, claimed that this would make Australia the world leader in the protection of the oceans and the ocean's marine ecosystems. Now, but what is being done to preserve Australia's most endangered species on land? There are 15 frogs, 16 reptiles, 44 birds, 55 mammals, 531 plants and one late night live presenter on the endangered species list. And among those closest to the brink are three mammals, the central rock rat, the bridled nail-tail wallaby and the numbat. Now, joining me to discuss this is my old friend and comrade, Tim Flannery, Chief Commissioner of Australia's Climate Commission, scientist, activist and author of more than a dozen books, almost all of which we've discussed on the program over the years. In his quarterly essay, good on your quarterly essay, you really do set the agenda for much of the important discussions in this country. His is entitled After the Future, Australia's New Extinction Crisis, and he investigates our efforts at preventing the extinction of endangered species. And I've got to tell you, it's disturbing reading. Even the optimistic Tim, however, has put forward some ways in which these extinctions can be halted. Tim joins me now from our Brisbane studio. Welcome back to our little wireless program, Timothy.
Thanks very much, Philip. It's a pleasure to be back with you, and I hope you don't expire this evening. We've got some important things to talk about.
Well, if I do, Norman Swan's not around. You see, if any Radio National presenter carks it, Norman rushes in and gives mouth-to-mouth, but I believe he's in Perth, so I'm flying solo. There are two words repeated throughout your essay, and these are dismay and dire. Okay, how dismayed are you at the dire rate of species extinction?
Well, we've had legislation in place to protect our endangered species now for more than 20 years, and over that entire time, only one species vulnerable to extinction has been taken off the list. So that says to me we're not doing a great job. So I'm pretty dismayed that, you know, we've put a lot of effort in, we've had the legislative framework, and yet we've been largely ineffective.
I'm going to read the essay's epigraph. When it suits them, men may take control and play fine tricks and hustle nature. Yet we may believe that Australia, quietly and imperceptibly, is experimenting on the men. She will be satisfied at long last. When she is satisfied, an Australian nation will in truth exist. Now, these are the words of an Australian historian, Sir Keith Hancock, written in 1930. What was he saying there?
Look, I think what he was, what Sir Keith was trying to express was this sense that we have to develop a culture and a way of life in Australia that is suited to the conditions of the continent, that are genuinely Australian, in other words. You know, back in 1930, when those words were written, a lot of people spoke about home, and it wasn't the home in, you know, Woollahra or anywhere else in Australia. It was with Britain they were talking about. So the development of that culture seemed a long way off back then, I think.
How, going back to the use of the word dire, this is you. Tragically, the kinds of extinctions seen in the Great Sandy Desert in the 70s are now devastating vast regions of our continent, including some of Australia's most valued national parks. Now, this concerns me. We've declared vast tracts of Australia as national parks, but the extinction process is not halted by this. You seem to feel that simply declaring a national park ain't good enough.
Well, it isn't, Philip. I mean, look, declaring a national park is the first step in protecting, you know, the nation's biodiversity. I guess 50 years ago, when, you know, all of this was pretty new, and Jock Marshall was writing about the need for a nationwide national park system, you know, perhaps people back then did think it was going to be okay, that would be enough. But we now know, with 50 years of experience and 13% of the country in national parks, that in fact, if we don't manage those parks, the biodiversity just continues to decline. And, you know, the great example of that is Kakadu, you know, which gets a budget of nearly $20 million a year. It is the jewel in the crown of the national park system. And over the past 25 years, biologists who survey every year in Kakadu have watched the relentless decline of the native fauna, to the point where now there's large parts of the park where you just don't see any native mammals, you know, much bigger than a mouse or smaller than the wallaby.
Well, not far from where I live, there's a largish national park, and these days, because of the Shooters Party and the dynamics of the New South Wales government, they're under pressure from people who want to go around bush bashing and blazing away with rifles. Is that a factor?
Well, we haven't seen, as far as I'm aware, very much shooting in national parks up to this point. I do comment on that proposal in the book. It's strange. What the O'Farrell government's decided to do is reduce the number of national parks rangers and then allow shooters into the parks as well. It seems to me, without a very explicit, at least, sense of what they're supposed to be achieving in these parks, what the targets are, what the goals are, how we're going to monitor any impact. We need to see that. If governments think that individual shooters, you know, can go into a national park and perhaps hunt feral animals and have some sort of impact, then we need to have a plan for that. You know, just making policy on the run with these sort of things, or maybe to please special interest groups, isn't doing biodiversity any favours.
I'm talking to Tim Flannery on LNL, and we're discussing his quarterly essay, After the Future, Australia's New Extinction Crisis. Tell us about the Christmas Island pipistrelle.
Well, the fate of the Christmas Island pipistrelle was really, I guess, what motivated me to write this essay. It was a small bat, a little insect-eating bat, unique to Christmas Island. And over 20 years, it went from being common and playing a really important role in the ecosystem, eating mosquitoes and moths and so forth, to becoming critically endangered. And on the 25th of August in 2009, biologists who'd watched this decline went out with a bat detector. It's a wonderful little machine that allows you to hear the calls of these small bats, and it's very effective in telling you if there's any about. And they detected a single bat that evening. The 26th of August, they went out and detected nothing, and the bat has not been heard from since.
Let me read the quite beautiful prose that you attached to the story. In late August 2009, a tiny solitary bat fluttered about in the rainforest near Australia's infamous Christmas Island detention camp. We don't know precisely what happened to it. Perhaps it landed on a leaf at dawn after a night feeding on moths and mosquitoes and was torn to pieces by invasive fire ants. Perhaps it succumbed to a mounting toxic burden placed on its tiny body by insecticide spraying. Or maybe it was simply worn out with age and ceaseless activity and died quietly in its tree hollow. But there is one important thing we do know. It was the very last Christmas Island pipistrelle on Earth. With its passing, an entire species winked out of existence. I mean, that is a beautiful piece of writing, but what an appalling story you tell.
It was heartbreaking for me. I trained as a mammalogist, and the mammal society that I'm part of was writing to ministers and others saying, we can save this bat. You know, we have a plan. If we can get some support, we'll do something. But
then you had an unfortunate meeting with Peter Garrett. Tell us about that.
Well, look, I did take that offer to save the bat from the Mammal Society to the minister, and we had a discussion about it, and I'd discovered that Peter Garrett, along with many other people in Australia, subscribed to the orthodoxy or the view that if we're to preserve biodiversity, we really need to focus on ecosystems and communities rather than individual species. And I really disagree with that view because, you know, ecosystems and communities are made up of individual species. How do we monitor our success if we're not looking at what the fate of individual species is? And, you know, that bat, that was the first mammal extinction in this country in 60 years.
And, the first in your lifetime.
First in my lifetime. It really had a big emotional impact on me because I had somehow, maybe it's my optimism, Philip, I don't know, but somehow thought that this generation might be a bit better than generations in the past and that we wouldn't tolerate the extinction of a species.
Tim, you point out that most of Australia's biodiversity consists of invertebrates such as insects and spiders and plants, but your main focus in the essay is on the face of the likes of wallabies and bandicoots, the medium-sized native mammals. Is that a tactic, a strategy, because we tend to respond to these creatures with more emotion?
Look, it's really based on the fact that those animals play a very important role in ecosystems. They move seeds about so that plants can germinate. They move fungal spores. They dig burrows and renew the soil. They're just very important. And beyond that, we can measure their numbers relatively easily. And if they're doing well, it's a reasonable bet that the rest of the ecosystem will be doing well in addition. So that's why I focus on them. You know, if we focused on every fly or every beetle in Australia, it'd be an endless task.
Okay, let's go back briefly to the pipistrelle. Its death, its extinction, how long will it take before we know what that means, why that matters?
Well, that's a really good question. And, you know, I guess you could take the view that whatever impact that has on Christmas Island is really meaningless to the world, isn't it? I mean, it is a small island. It may be that some moth that was preyed on by the bat, you know, will eventually grow to such numbers it'll overwhelm various tree species or whatever. I mean, all that sort of thing's possible. But I think really in the case of the Christmas Island pipistrelle and species like that, we're dealing more with a moral dilemma. It's, you know, most people may not have known about the bat and would never have known about it if it hadn't gone.
It's significant to me that it's happening on Christmas Island. The poor little creature was a refugee, in effect, on Christmas Island, wasn't it?
A refugee in its own country, indeed it was. And we didn't lift a finger to help. We knew about it for 3 years, people dithered, and nothing was done.
When was the first extinction wave in Australia, Tim, and what did we lose?
Well, that followed pretty hotly on the heels of the Europeans when they arrived in 1788. We started to see extinctions by the 1840s. Things like the white-footed rabbit rat that was noted by the convicts as being a pest in the government stores in the 1790s. You know, it was gone by the middle of the 19th century and really culminated with the extinction of a few very notable species like the thylacine, which, you know, went in 1936. There was a few extinctions that petered on beyond that, but, you know, by the 1940s, we seemed to have been through the worst of that extinction wave. And, you know, people hoped, I suppose, that we wouldn't have a recurrence. But, you know, what we've seen since then is the building of this second wave, which is now just starting to break and sweep away the biodiversity of northern Australia and the remnants in the south and centre of those middle-sized mammals that survived the first wave.
It's interesting, isn't it, Tim, that very often creatures seem to remain common until the moment of their vanishing.
Well, that is one of the most amazing things about that first extinction wave, that the species that were affected were often the most abundant in the environment. I mean, 9 species of native rodents, some of which look a bit like house mice and things like that, they must have been exceptionally abundant. I mean, John Gould talks about catching some under the fence post at the local homestead he was staying at, and yet they went, you know, within a few decades, by the 1850s, they were gone. So something had changed in the ecosystem that brought disaster to those species.
I'm talking to Australia's best-known crusader on the issue of climate change, for which he is much vilified. I think it's fair to say there are a great many people around who would like to see Tim Flannery extinct, but I'm delighted to have him on LNL, on RN. Now, Australians would go into total panic if the word extinction were to be applied to something like the koala or the eastern grey. But explain why we should be concerned about the loss of a native rat or similar little critters.
Look, one example that's very relevant at this moment is a creature called the central rock rat, which is on the brink of extinction now. It was, you know, a century ago it was common. There was a few populations surviving into the 1980s to 90s. Now there is one or two tiny populations clinging to life on the highest summits of the mountains of Central Australia. And that rock rat has done a very important job in the ecology of Central Australia for a long time. You still find its caches of seeds up in the rocky escarpments, and those seeds have been harvested from trees some distance away, and they're economically important trees, things
but
like quondong
and so
forth.
But you make another sort of point in the essay, which I think is extraordinarily important. First and foremost, you say, it's a matter of values. The demise of a bat may not weigh greatly in the balance of human well-being, but speaks volumes about the human soul. Do we wish to be despoilers, executioners of the natural world, or do we want our kids to have the opportunity to enjoy a world as bountiful and diverse as the one our parents bequeathed to us? That's one of my arguments. My arguments, everyone's arguments against capital punishment. You know, it kills the community that practices it.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And, you know, when I tried to think, you know, when we are horrified by torture, even if it's being practiced in a distant prison that we'll never visit on someone who we'll never know and may never know about, we're still horrified by it because it is fundamentally wrong. It diminishes all of us. And the same is true of species extinctions. I mean, these animals that are going extinct now, Philip, have been really, Aboriginal people have been their custodians for 40,000 years, and through their fire management and management of the environment overall, many of these species have come down to the present day.
Previously, and I remember you and I discussing this years ago, previously you also acknowledged the very real probability, that fire management wiped out some species as well.
Well, I think hunting wiped out species in the very early days of Aboriginal settlement of Australia. There's no, I'm pretty convinced of that. But
this is particularly the megafauna?
That's right, the really large, you know, rhinoceros-sized wombats and those sort of things. But at that time, all of the small animals that are now going extinct, they were all around back then as well. And they faced a great challenge with that extinction event because fires would have swept through the land with the extinction of the large marsupials, a bit like the way fires will sweep through a paddock today if you take the cattle out and let the grass grow really rank and tall and dry out. You know, it'll carry a fire. And for those small animals, that's a catastrophe because they have to find shelter and food every day. And you need a very patchy environment to provide that. They can't travel long distances. And if they do try to, they're exposed and predators will pick them off.
Yeah. So, okay. Yeah. Tim, who conducts the census on our various species? You know, how do we know where they are, how many they are, conditions, numbers, etc.?
Well, a short answer to that, Philip, at the moment is that no one does. There's various organisations that do bits and pieces of that. And in times past, actually, we were a little bit better at it because we had state museums that were relatively well funded and staffed with experts and you know, groups like the CSIRO that had similar expertise. Look, a lot of that has been diminished. You know, when I joined the Australian Museum in Sydney in 1984, there were 30 experts, scientific experts, right across the disciplines of animals, from arachnids, you know, spiders through to worms. Today, there's only a dozen experts full-time at the museum. So we're losing that capacity not just to measure individuals and how many individuals are left, but actually even classify and identify species. And all of that's an important element in terms of our care for the environment.
I understand that there is a register of subspecies and species and communities that are threatened, and by law, each entity included on the list should have a detailed recovery plan written for it. Is there enough money? Are there enough people to prepare such plans?
Well, that legislation you refer to is that the Endangered Species Act, which should provide protection, effective protection for these species. It's not just a matter of money and expertise that sees that fail, but you know, as I said, you know that legislation's been in place now for more than 20 years, and it's only.
But it wasn't enough to save this dear little bat, was it?
Of course not.
It didn't impress or persuade the minister.
No, and the failings are numerous in that, but let's go through the process. You know, first of all, a species has to be put on the list. Then a plan, or what's called a recovery plan, has to be written for that species. And then that plan has to find funding, so you have to get funding for that. And then the funding has to be effectively applied. And at every step in that process, we see failure. So in New South Wales, for example, over the last 20 years, only of all the species listed, only 10% of them have had recovery plans written for them. At that rate, it would take another two centuries to write the plans that are the first step.
Tim, is there one successful recovery plan that you can point to?
There has been, and that was the saltwater crocodile, which faced a pretty simple problem. It was almost hunted into extinction. Once the government passed legislation to ban the hunting of saltwater crocodiles, the species recovered. So that was a simple solution to a relatively simple problem. But when you come to the land-based ecosystems and so forth, you actually need to put some effort into it, some money into it, and some effort and some accountability. And there are groups that do this, but we're not seeing it on the scale that is required to solve the problem.
The other night I was discussing the frog with someone who's written an interesting monograph on the little creatures, and we were talking about the mysterious disappearance of the frogs around the world. And, of course, often extinction is multifactorial, infinitely complex and not fully understood.
That's right, but nevertheless, there are instances in Australia where species have started to recover in numbers given the right management technique. And can I just give you one example of that?
Yes, please. Cheer me up.
Yeah. I told you about Kakadu, where things are going extinct despite the budget, $20 million a year budget that's being used. There's another organisation called the Australian Wildlife Conservancy, and I'm on the board of that organisation, so I've got to declare an interest there, which is managing properties across Northern Australia, and thereby managing feral species like cattle, horses and donkeys and so forth, and managing fire. We've managed to see a spectacular recovery of the smaller mammals and species like the Gouldian finch, a rare bird which was in decline because of adverse fire regimes, as we discovered. But in order to do that, you've got to have the funding, you've got to have the scientific expertise, and you've got to be accountable. And there's not many organisations that have all of those things going for them.
Okay. Why are the action plans not working? Is it because they're not sufficiently sophisticated? Is it because there's a lack of money? What's going wrong?
Look, I think there's problems with every step of the way, but let's assume we've got an action plan that promises to put a species on the road to recovery. You then look around for funding. Well, there is no pool of funding provided by the federal government or any other government specifically for this purpose. So you've got to go to some other funding agency, which may have its own agenda, may partially fund you or not fund you at all, And then, there's a learning process involved in all of this, and these are very long-term projects.
Forgive me interrupting, but I suddenly realise that, of course, corporations pour money into football teams with animal names, don't they? Why don't corporate sponsorship of beleaguered animals?
Well, that happens to some extent, but most of the money for preserving Australia's biodiversity comes from donations from ordinary Australians, you know, effectively with groups like the Australian Wildlife Conservancy. But, you know, what we need, Philip, I think, is government and these agencies to be working together effectively to produce the outcomes we all want. How do you get accountability in that? You know, one of my suggestions was that the federal government needs to set up an independent authority which distributes funding for the purposes of making sure that we don't see more extinctions, and that that agency itself is held accountable then by the federal government.
You actually put $15,000 of your own money into, in an attempt to kickstart a program to save the central rock rat. Did that work?
Well, I offered to do that, you know, on the basis that we would bring some animals into captivity so that we could at least, you know, have some animals survive, because they are absolutely on the brink of extinction. But we couldn't get the action to occur. And, you know, one of the problems is these recovery plans, they take forever to write, and that one's still being written.
I suppose we're watching one right at the moment with the that grumpy little creature in Tasmania that, you know, is in big, big trouble, but may survive on the mainland or in certain quarantine areas. Is it possible to bring an animal like that back from the brink in artificial circumstances and then to successfully release them into the wild?
Yeah, sure. And sometimes you need to do that. You know, overseas we've seen that sort of thing happen with the California condor, for example, where the whole wild population was brought into captivity and then bred up and then re-released.
And I understand, with at least one breed of wolf.
I'm not aware of that, but it may well be the case, Philip, as well. But there are several examples around the world. I think one of the Arabian oryx is another one, where they've been brought into captivity, or the Przewalski's horse, another one from Asia. So that does work. And in Australia, we're doing something like that by creating these large fenced areas to protect the small marsupials from being eaten by foxes and cats, for example, just so that we have a viable population while we learn how to deal with these threats.
You know, the irony here, or the paradox, and you pointed out in the essay, is that today there are hundreds, if not thousands, of groups who are concerned about environmental matters, from the land care movement to the myriad self-organising bands of bush regenerators and carers for local parks and gardens that have sprung up continent-wide. In other words, there's a huge volunteer army who want to do something, and yet it ain't working.
That's right. I think the community really wants some action on this, and people do put their own time, money and effort into improving environmental outcomes. But the processes that we've designed as a people and that are administered by government are not up to the job. So that's what needs to change.
Perhaps later in the program we'll have time to talk at least briefly about the politics of climate change. But surely this is one area where there'd be bipartisan concern and bipartisan support for saving in animals in jeopardy.
Well, I'd like to think that was the case, Philip, and I think in an earlier age it might have been, you know, because people from the right side of politics in earlier times were great environmental champions. And I mention in the book the role Henry Bolte played, surprisingly, in terms of setting up the national park system in Victoria, and was lauded for that by, you know, some very critical people in the environment movement at the time.
I remember, in fact, you quoting William Souder, the most recent biographer of Rachel Carson, about the way environmental conversation used to be an agreed concern on both the left and the right. And he writes, conservation was a hopeful, noble, and inherently non-partisan cause, a quest for the betterment of the world. Its foundation was the conviction that we could protect and enjoy what nature provided in perpetuity. From generation to generation, a well-tended earth would endure. But most recently, that, you know, what I was asking you before was in fact to Dorothy Dixer, most recently the far right has been attacking anything seen as green.
Well, that's right. And I think it is the far right. I think it's really important to understand that there are many people on the right side of politics who do care about the environment. But there's this insidious virus almost, I think, coming out of some extreme libertarians. who see environmental stewardship as being some sort of lefty or green, you know, plot or something.
And yet, far from being a lefty conspiracy, environmental stewardship inspired many of the right's most prominent leaders: Theodore Roosevelt, Reagan, Fraser, dear old Rupert Hamer, even Garfield Barwick, to patriotic acts of significance.
That's right. I think when you look back, you know, the right has played probably a disproportionately important role in nature conservation until recent decades. And I guess, you know, the nature of the environmental challenge has changed. Rachel Carson was really the turning point in some ways, where she saw that the industrial use of pesticides were a great threat, and that set up a very hotly contested debate which involved government, industry and the public. And the way industry tried to win that debate was basically by trying to denigrate Rachel Carson.
Let me raise the issue of religion. I grew up in a world where the environment as a notion had not yet been kindled, and where, you know, the Old Testament gave humanity carte blanche to do with the world, with its creatures, pretty much what it wanted. Later on, I can vividly remember Ronald Reagan having a Secretary of the Interior who was a Christian fundamentalist who believed that any moment the rapture would occur, and he was authorising or advocating, you know, mining and drilling in national parks, as of course the ultra-right in America are currently doing as well. And his argument was, in effect, that we could shrug off the world like an old overcoat because we wouldn't need it much longer. Has there been a pendulum swing amongst the religious of the world to see the world as a sacred trust?
Oh, gee, Philip, that's a really tough question. Look, there's always been St. Francis. He's for the Catholics, at least, he's held the flag in that regard for a long time.
I don't think he's around anymore, though, is he? I think he's
Franciscans,
extinct.
Though. The Franciscans are doing their thing still there about. And, you know, there are people. Paul Collins is a great example, you know, someone who deeply cares about the earth and sees it as God's gift to
us. Look, I know
us.
There are prominent individuals, but I remember a couple of years ago there was an argument that even amongst the fundamentalists, you know, in the Bible Belt in America, there was, as is often the case, a conflict between parent and child, and a lot of kids were picking up on the environment as a significant and, indeed, a religious issue. You have not seen much evidence of that here?
Oh, look, I think there's some. You know, I think the religious fraternity alike, they represent a cross-section of all of us. There's those who are deeply committed to environmental issues and deeply concerned, and those who, for whatever reason, don't care. I must say I find it hard to understand how you could not care unless you did believe the rapture was just around the corner, because it's the earth that gives us life. It's, you know, it creates and helps keep clean the air we breathe, you know, makes the food we eat. We can't live without it.
Okay. I had Robin Davidson on the program a couple of weeks ago, the famous camel lady, and she's just been retracing some of her steps and the pads of her camels, and she's been astonished at how profoundly the desert regions of Australia have changed. Are the deserts under as much threat as the mountains, as the valleys, as say the Murray Darling?
Yeah, probably even more, Philip. The, you know, the mountains is where our biodiversity has survived best. They're complex environments with lots of little micro habitats and so forth, and shelters from fire and dense thickets that predators find it hard to get into. Whereas the deserts, you know, there's not many hiding places in the desert, and you know, they've seen the brunt of the extinctions. You know, while Aboriginal people were managing them, it was fine. And you know, we know from the aerial photography taken for the Woomera rocket tests that Aboriginal people were doing that very effectively right through the 50s, 60s and 70s. And if you look at that aerial photography, you can see how the system slowly starts to break down as Aboriginal people are brought in to mission stations and outstations and so forth. And then wildfires really take hold and the animals go.
With Australia having over 22 million people and a continent of nearly 8 million square kilometres, is it imaginable that we would ever find the money and the will to do what needs to be done?
I think that's a pretty fair question. But when you look at the studies that have been done so far and the actual on-the-ground experience, the answer is an unequivocal yes. You know, studies in the Kimberley, for example, have shown that to preserve the biodiversity of the Kimberley would cost something like $40 million a year. That's upkeep on one of our premier tourist attractions. That's a no-brainer. It's simple. It's a small amount of money for an enormous return. If you look at groups like the Australian Wildlife Conservancy, you know, on a budget of $12 million a year, they're preserving 3 million hectares of land around Australia, 70% of the endangered mammals and 73% of the birds. So, yes, it can be done. You've got to have those magic ingredients, though, don't you? You've got to have the scientific expertise. Got to have the capacity and you've got to be accountable. You've got to have accountability.
Okay, before I change direction in our discussion tonight, you believe we need one single agency to distribute funding at a federal level and further, and that the people whose job it is to save species should be held accountable.
Absolutely. At the moment, when species go extinct, there's a bit of finger pointing, but there's no one who's accountable. And that's what we need. And that's why I say we probably need an independent authority. So an authority that's independent of the government, that can be monitored by government in terms of its success or not, who's responsible for distributing funding to other groups who can actually do the on-ground work that's required. And then if we're still not achieving what we need to do, that authority can be placed with someone who'd be more competent.
Have you seen anywhere in the world where the system is working better?
I think Australia's problems are unique, you know, Philip. In a place like Africa or Europe to some extent, you know, if people pull out of an ecosystem, if they just leave it alone, it tends to heal itself, you know. But here in Australia, you know, there's 72 introduced vertebrate species, there's feral pests, there's fire issues. The only place like us really is New Zealand. And there they have had a change recently where what they've done is taken an approach recommended by some Australian scientists to really focus their funding, and they're doing three times better than they were before that.
You know, we might be about to enter an era of benign neglect in that a great many people in the bush, people with farms, and we've done this at Elmswood, are locking up large areas, encouraged by the principle of, you know, retaining carbon in the soil and in the plants. Might such a change of tack be helpful in this country?
Well, I think it's probably a good thing of itself. But it's not going to protect our biodiversity. To do that, we need that active management. You know, we need to deal with those 72 species of vertebrate pests, whether they're cane toads or foxes. You know, cats are a great example. I love cats, Philip, but I've got to acknowledge they eat 70 million native animals a day in this country.
Tim, come closer. I'm going to tell you a secret, and it's one of the dark secrets of this program. Many years ago, I confessed, this is just between you and I, that I actually shoot the odd feral cat at the farm, and that unleashed the greatest wave of hate mail I've ever had. So let's not even mention cats.
All right.
We'll both get into terrible trouble. Now,
I see.
Talking about the terrible trouble that you get into, you've really copped an immense amount of flack from the climate change deniers. How have you handled that emotionally?
Well, it was a pretty tough 18 months, you know, in the lead up to July 1. There was a lot of flack. There was threats and all sorts of things. But I guess I decided early on that if you want to change something, you're going to make some enemies. And you've got to stick by your guns. It's not easy making that sort of change. And thankfully, we're starting to see things turn around. You know, since July 1, when the carbon tax came in, a lot of the fear in the community has evaporated. And that's tremendously helpful in terms of then getting a better quality of discussion around the issue.
We watched with fascinated horror the way the term climate change or any euphemism thereof disappeared from the political debate during the never-ending presidential agitations. None of the Republican contenders would talk about it, or if they did, they'd brush it aside as left-wing nonsense. And even the sainted Obama stopped mentioning it at all. But in his triumphant acceptance speech the other night, he actually used the words climate change for the first time that I can remember in many, many, many a month. Do you think the current crises that are whipping across America are changing the Americans' attitudes? Because unless they change, we're all ruined.
Yeah, look, there is some evidence that things are changing in the US. The drought conditions seen earlier in the year there really shocked people. You know, there was they were entirely extraordinary. And then Hurricane Sandy, of course, really brought the point home. And even Mayor Bloomberg mentioned climate change as one of the things that had to be dealt with. And, you know, I suppose what we're seeing with those events is that, you know, weather is operating now in a different context. You know, there is 5% more moisture in the air. That changes things. Sea levels are higher than ever before. The Arctic ice is melting, and all of that has an impact on these weather patterns. So I think there is a greater acknowledgement in the US that climate change is an issue.
And is there a greater acknowledgement on our side of the argument that we're dealing with the most complex of all systems, and that perhaps some of our earlier predictions may have been a bit off?
Yeah, look, science is an ongoing process of self-correction. You know, you can never prove anything in science. You can only disprove things. Hurricanes are a great example. You know, 6 or 7 years ago, scientists thought there was evidence of a trend for increasing numbers of cyclones as the planet warmed and increasing intensity of those cyclones. They now think that perhaps the numbers are not increasing, but that the intensity of some may be increasing. So, yes, we learn and change as we go along, and the data reflects that. But
I remember you saying at the time that Katrina was almost certainly a consequence of global warming and there would be many more of them. That's still your position?
Well, at the time I said that, the data was pointing to cyclones becoming more frequent and more intense. What I think we see today is that there's certainly some very intense storms, but the frequency isn't as great. So the way scientists, including myself, these days talk about hurricanes in the climate context is that these great engines of destruction, these cyclones, are operating in a different context. They're operating in a context where sea levels are higher, where there's more moisture in the atmosphere, where the Arctic ice cap's breaking up and other changes are occurring, and that inevitably affects them and their impacts.
I wrote a column the other day about long-term drought being in effect a bushfire in slow motion and the great difficulty that animals have with coping. Now, already we're seeing, as a result of climate change, very different patterns in where fish are gathering, where sharks are swimming. I'm wondering how quickly animals can adapt to this slow-motion bushfire.
Well, that's a really great question. In terms of the marine environment, the changes are quite marked already. So the Great Barrier Reef is a good example of that. And in fact, on Heron Island, there's a wonderful little experimental station there where they've recreated the seawater of 200 years ago, you know, by manipulating its temperature and by taking some of the CO2 out of it. And you can see the corals in that tank, they're growing fantastically. And you compare it with the seawater today just drawn straight off the reef and the corals are struggling. But they've also created the seawater of the future 100 years from now, as we think it may be. And there, boy, that's a dismal sight. So undoubtedly...
What an extraordinary experiment. They're predicting what seawater will be like down the track and already simulating it.
That's right, yeah. We can predict the temperature, the average temperature. We can predict the CO2 concentrations in the water. So yes, you can. You can create the seawater of the future and recreate the seawater of the past and see how things go. And the differences are astonishing.
I remember you and I having a private conversation when you were still running the museum in Adelaide, and you were absolutely profoundly alarmed, you know, to the extent that well, you were as alarmed as anyone I knew about the issue in Australia or anywhere else. Is there any cause for optimism?
Yeah, I think there is. You know, we've seen just over the last 12 months the amount of money being invested in clean energy technologies exceed that of fossil fuel technologies for the first time in human history. So that's encouraging. Some of the technologies themselves are really changing in terms of price. So solar panels, for example, the cost of production has fallen 75% in just 4 years. So that's bringing them really much more within the reach of people. Australia itself, in terms of solar installations, is 17 years ahead of government predictions in the earlier energy white paper. So things are happening quickly. There are changes. But, you know, in the case, as Australia is a good example, you know, as we reduce emissions from electricity, because that's happening very effectively now in Australia, unfortunately emissions from aviation and from mining continue to grow. So we need to redouble our efforts.
Coal mining is by no means extinct. You were a great enthusiast for hot rocks. I remember, in fact, you were an investor in that pilot scheme. Any encouraging developments?
Oh, I think I'll reap my reward in heaven for that one, Philip. I'm not hoping for great outcomes in this life.
But nonetheless, the idea of hot rocks is one of the is one of enormous significance, isn't it? Promise.
It is, and in places like New Zealand and Indonesia, it's working out, and Philippines, to be quite an important part of the energy mix. But the technologies here in Australia in those very deep rocks is probably a little way off yet. So, you know, we shall see. But at the moment, what we are seeing in terms of energy generation in Australia is that wind and solar are really going very, very strongly, developing very strongly. And
tidal, we're seeing a drop in the amount of coal.
Not so much. Tidal is it's restricted in its application, and a bit like wave power. You know, there's a couple of early stage developments in that area, but those technologies are nowhere near as well as advanced as wind. We're getting the first gearless wind turbines in this country next year, which will be a big technological breakthrough. And of course, solar now everywhere. We led the world in individual installations last year, and we'll do very well again this year.
A cat-loving colleague has just typed up on my computer screen. Can you ask Tim whether he really said that feral cats kill 70 million native animals per day, or did we misunderstand?
No, that's about it. That's the figures I've heard. You know, people who study cats in the wild, they'll open up a cat and there'll be half a dozen to a dozen small animals in its stomach, lizards, native mice, birds, so forth, and that's a day's feed.
Okay, so we're winding up shortly, but I'm remembering other conversations you and I have had. One of them was when you came back from a China trip, and although by no means a great enthusiast for authoritarian regimes, you were pretty impressed with the way a central government could in fact dictate that things had to change and see some consequences of that. And we both worried at the time, and I still worry, about whether the democratic system is inherently capable of making the big decisions that will prevent our own extinction.
Look, it's a fair question, but you'd have to say, looking at the US over the last couple of years, that you can see the dynamism of the market-based system. You know, the amount of coal burnt in the US has declined now 19% in a single year, as gas has really taken up the slack. And I mean, it's fuel switching, but to a much less carbon-dense fuel, and happening at an astonishing speed. I think mountaintop removal in the US is on its absolute last legs now as well.
Praise the Lord for that.
Yeah, finally, but for the same sort of reason. And you know, the market is such a dynamic thing, and I think as we see the price of some of the renewables drop, we'll be surprised at the speed at which they're taken up.
We've had a few theologians from the free market on the program lately who have suggested that in fact it'll be the massive engineering projects, the fiddling around with the atmosphere, the deployment of vast mirrors, etc., 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 that will save the day, and that they are in fact reveling in the crisis because they can see it making the big quid.
Yeah, well, we shall see. Look, I think there may ultimately be a need for some of those technologies, but particularly the technologies that take CO2 out of the atmosphere, because the mirrors and things, they still leave you with the big problems of acidifying oceans and whatever else.
And how do we take it out of the atmosphere, Tim?
Well, plants do it extremely well. That's what they do. But there are artificial photosynthesis and artificial means of taking CO2 out of the atmosphere. And perhaps one day, although we can barely see the beginning of it now, you know, that CO2 can be used to make things like plastics and building materials and whatever else that we may use. But that is way, way into the future. At the moment, the desperate need is to reduce the emissions that are going into the atmosphere.
It's not just the conservatives who are raising again and again the issue of nuclear power. You know, some quite reasonable people see it as the least worst option if, you know, for baseload. Do you imagine that, or do you agree that nuclear power is sometimes the least worst?
Look, not in Australia. In a place like China, maybe, where they need everything, yes. But look, the renewables are just, they're coming down in price so much. We're learning to use the grid in ways that mean they can carry a big lot of the load. In Germany, for example, on a sunny Sunday nowadays, 50% of the electricity that's being used is coming from solar power. You know, I never thought I'd see the day that was the case, but it is. So baseload argument, I think, is now by and large, a redundant one. We don't need to worry about that. And the renewables, because we can all own them, we can all be prosumers. You know, what we can see with that, as producers and consumers of electricity, what we're seeing is a bit like the net with the media. You know, there used to be media moguls and media empires. Now anyone can do it. The same will be true for electricity.
Tim, thanks for your time. Tim Flannery, Chief Commissioner of the Australian Climate Commission, a scientist and, to say the least, an author. His quarterly essay is called After the Future, Australia's New Extinction Crisis, published by Black Ink. Good on you, Black Ink. On our next, I'll be talking to someone called Bruce Shapiro. He's a new bloke we're trying out. We'll also be discussing the way Twitter has been used by the Israeli Defence Force in the latest attacks on Gaza. Oh, and we welcome back to the Wireless Program Ian Guthridge, former Jesuit priest and theologian, about whether religion is faith, fact, or fantasy. Oh, I hope he doesn't change my mind.